Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Shakespeare and Company. Our guest tonight is Viet Thanh Nguyen, here to discuss his engrossing new work, A Man of Two Faces, a memoir, a history, a memorial. As the subtitle suggests, it's a book about family and memory and storytelling and history on all the levels that it impacts upon a life. It's also a book that draws much of its immense force from an accumulation of tensions. The tension between the singular and plural existence. The tension between the self-controlled academic and the freewheeling storyteller. The tension between the Vietnamese child and the American adult. The tension between the refugee and the immigrant. The tension between the son who wants to make his parents proud and the reprobate who defines himself against them. The tension between two Marxisms, Karl's and Groucho's. The tension between the activist who sees injustice and moral outrage in black and white and the novelist who must reside in the grey areas. The tension between languages and their lexicons. The tension between the Pulitzer Prize winner embraced by the literary establishment and the iconoclast who wants to tear that establishment down. The tension between what we remember, what we don't, and what we have chosen to forget. Viet Thanh Nguyen has such assurance and skill as a writer that in A Man of Two Faces, he not only sets down these tensions, raw and in many cases unresolved, on the page, but sets them down in such a way that they overlap, interact, and ultimately produce that strange alchemical thing, a work of art. There's so much to talk about in this book, so let's get to it. Please join me in welcoming Viet Thanh Nguyen to Shakespeare and Company.
Thank you, Adam. Such a pleasure to be back here at Shakespeare and Company. And thanks for reminding me I have all these tensions that I'm going to manage desperately, even now.
Well, let's see if we can resolve some of them.
Never.
I suppose where I'd like to begin is with the subject of memory and memoir. So first of all, you've written two highly acclaimed novels. You've written a collection of short stories. Of course, you've been an academic and published academic articles before. But what was it that drew you to the memoir form at this stage in your life and this stage in your writing career?
Nothing drew me to the memoir form. In fact, I'm a reluctant memoirist, which I think is a good thing, because if I was an enthusiastic memoirist, you should be very scared. Do not trust enthusiastic memoirists. But you know, I've been, as an academic and as a fiction writer, I've dealt with a lot of very personal and political and historical concerns, but I've hidden my personal investments under the language of academia or under the language of fiction. But in the last few years, I've become increasingly aware that, in fact, my autobiography has played an enormous role in shaping who I am as a writer. And I think the first acknowledgement of that was when I was giving a talk in a much larger environment, several hundred people. And I started to talk about my parents and the grocery store that they ran when they came to California in the late 1970s, a store called the Saigon Mui, which was probably the second Vietnamese grocery store in San Jose. And of course, I had known that my parents ran this grocery store. They ran it for over a decade, and that was simply a fact of my life. So I started to describe this grocery store to this audience, and all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed by emotion, and I couldn't continue. And anybody who knows me knows I am never overwhelmed by emotion. So I realized that there was something that I had contained, sealed away, and that what I thought that I was a very well-functioning human being, even though my wife had continually advised me otherwise. And so I think at that point I had reached a sufficient maturity as a writer and as a human being to try to then finally look towards this past that I had left behind.
And in the book we're going to delve into in a minute, we have the sense of there is a you struggle, in a sense, with the idea of memory. Like often when one reads, let's say, what might be considered a more traditional memoir, I mean, I as a reader, I'm often sort of astonished by how much the writer seems to remember, or at least perhaps pretends to remember. But it seems from the very beginning of the book that you're not only writing about your memories, but you're writing about the subject of memory itself.
No, absolutely. I like reading memoirs. I've read a lot of memoirs. I read enough memoirs to know that I didn't want to write the conventional memoir, which was a reconstruction of one's life to make it as smooth as possible. And maybe that's how some people experience their lives, but that has never been how I experienced my own memory. In fact, I experienced my own memory as very fragmented, nonlinear, deeply disturbing in a lot of ways. And one of the memoirs that I was working against was Nabokov's Speak Memory, which is a wonderful memoir, but it's a very smooth and seamless account of his youth and his refugee experiences. And I thought that my memoir would be in many ways the opposite, that a memoir that acknowledges the holes and the fissures in our memory, And Nabokov actually went, and I think he interviewed family members to make sure he got the facts right and so on. I didn't interview anybody because I didn't want a reconstruction. I wanted the readers to experience my own past as I experienced it. And so there are places where I do my best to reconstruct from what I remembered. And then there are places where my memory is an utter blank and I leave it as is. Because the reason why the memory is an utter blank is because the experience was so difficult, so traumatic for me, that I did not want to pretend that somehow I had overcome my refusal to remember.
And even moments where, at least one moment specifically, I remember where you remember something one way and your brother remembers it a different way. And I liked the fact that we found that sort of on the page. Like there was no attempt to necessarily resolve it, but to present it as kind of the authenticity of both of your experiences.
Yeah, only two people read the memoir after it was finished before I sent it to my publisher. One was my wife, and then the other was my brother. My brother was the only one left from my family who had the memory to remember everything we had been through. And so after I finished it, I sent it to him. I said, look, I wrote this memoir. I think you should see it before it's ever published and everybody else reads it. And he said, fine. And then I didn't hear from him for months.
Yeah.
And then at a family gathering, my sister-in-law, his wife, said, yeah, your brother has your manuscript and he just won't read it. And he finally did read it because I told my wife and she told my sister-in-law and my sister-in-law told my brother. So we don't communicate directly, but another sign of our family life. But then he did read it. And then he said, this is accurate or this is true, or at least this is because you believe, you remember it this way, then you can write it this way. So he's always been a great big brother in that sense.
Should we hear a first little extract?
So a little bit about what you need to know is that I was born in Vietnam in 1971 and then came as a refugee in 1975. And we settled initially in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania after our time in a refugee camp. And then we moved to San Jose in 1978. And my parents opened a grocery store there around that time. It's called the Saigon Mui, and this is a description of what that store was like in the 70s and 1980s. When my brother graduates as valedictorian of San Jose High, the San Jose Mercury of 1982 profiles him and describes Bama's Saigon Mui as a miniature department store overflowing with bolts of silk and Vietnamese books, in addition to Indo-Chinese groceries and American junk food. A miniature department store. Why did I never imagine this humble enterprise of my parents in this manner? Creaking accordion gates protect the storefront, protesting every time they're opened and closed. Long tongues of sticky yellow paper dangle from the ceiling, studded with dead flies. White rice in 50-pound sacks is stacked to the rafters. In the back, a butcher hacks at fish and meat while I stamp prices in purple ink on cans of grass jelly and lychees in syrup. Soy sauce, oyster sauce, nuoc mam, and mam ruoc in a sickly shade of purple. Coco Rico coconut soda in green cans, a machine for grinding coffee whose aroma mixes with the rice. JVC stereos with cassette players in boxes behind the counter, which my parents send home to our relatives who sell them for cash. Why do they need cash? And why can we not just send cash if they need it? My life with Ba Ma, defined by questions I never ask. Under the glass counter are Chinese martial arts paperback novels translated into Vietnamese, which my brother can read, but I can't and never will. I'm 8. I can and do eat all the Chinese donuts and fried sesame seed balls I want, as well as Danish butter cookies in blue tins and sugary lady fingers and chocolate-covered cherries that pop and ooze in my mouth. I've not tasted any of them again since the days of the Saigon Mui. What would happen if I ate a chocolate-covered cherry now? Would I remember all I have forgotten or tried to forget?
Thank you so much. That idea of trying to forget is interesting. As I said, you have this sort of relationship with memory, which is sort of quite complicated and quite sort of, I guess, kind of fluid as the book advances. At a couple of moments, you mention the COVID pandemic during the book. Am I right in thinking the book was, at least in some part, written during that time? And if so, could you talk a little bit about how that experience affected the writing and the ultimate form of the book?
Well, as we all were, I was cooped up during the pandemic. And one of the things that I did was to look into an archive that I had kept since my university days at UC Berkeley in a little box. And I had kept my essays and writings in there. And I found an essay that I had written for my professor, Maxine Hong Kingston. So when I was 19, I went to Berkeley and I took a class with Maxine Hong Kingston, who's a very famous writer. Her book, The Woman Warrior, was at the time perhaps the most widely taught book on college campuses in the United States. I was 19. What did I care? I was very lucky to get in this class of 14 students. I would sit about this far away from Maxine every day. And every day, I would fall asleep. At the end of the semester, Maxine wrote everybody a letter. My letter said, "You seem to be deeply alienated. Maybe you should make use of our university's excellent psychological services," which I did not do. I became a writer instead. the positive side of that story is Maxine said I was the worst student in her class. All right, look at me now. So, anyway, so I put the essay away, and the essay that I'd written for her was about my mother going to a psychiatric facility. And I did not look at that essay again for 30 years until the pandemic. And during the 30 years, I knew I had written the essay. I knew my mother had gone to a psychiatric facility. And I remembered that time as happening when I was a little boy. So in the pandemic, I open up the essay. It's 10 pages long. I read it and I realize I'd forgotten everything that I had written in this essay. I'd forgotten all the details and the features of the psychiatric facility, the people who were in it, what my mother was like, how I reacted to it. And I'd forgotten that I had written that essay when I was 19 and my mother had gone to the psychiatric facility the year before. Mm-hmm. So even as a full-grown adult, my own memory had been capable of completely distorting what had happened and changed really basic facts. And I'm a scholar of memory, and I can talk about it in all kinds of abstract and academic ways and everything like that. But this was a very visceral experience for me in terms of realizing how self-deceptive our own individual memories can be.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, one thing, the concept of the self is very important to this book. And in fact, the way that the self divides at time, to use the phrase of Adi Lang, like there's a kind of both a singular self and a multiplicity of selves in this book. And for certain sections of the book, not the part you just read us, but you don't write in the first person, but instead you use the you. You're sort of addressing, it's an odd experience as a reader because it feels like sometimes when we're reading it, we have the sense that you are addressing yourself, and sometimes we have the sense that you are addressing us. And it's ever so slightly sort of discombobulating. Could you talk a little bit about how that sort of, I guess, the voice for the book, that sort of the divided voice between the I and the you came about?
Well, first of all, let me say that when I was writing the book, I had a lot of fun for the first two thirds. Mm-hmm. And then I get into my mother's story. And I had a lot of fun, and that was really important to me because if you read the book, there's lots of various kinds of play that are taking place in the book, including the shift from I to you, and I play with formatting and things like this. I used the word play because I was having fun. And the impetus for all of that was because I became a father, and reading children's books with my kids, with my son especially, one of the things I realized is that children's book writers have no rules. They can do whatever they want. And no kid ever asks twice about why Dog Man is a human body with a dog's head and is a super cop. No kid has ever asked that question. And it's a great series from Dave Pilkey. And so I was like, why do children's book writers and poets have all this freedom, but prose writers of fiction or nonfiction, if we deviate at all from someone's from the general perceptions of what a novel or a memoir are supposed to look like, we're all of a sudden avant-garde, experimental writers and so on. I don't think I'm that way at all. So it's all purely out of play. And at the moment when the book shifts from first to second person, it was a purely intuitive decision and is a contradiction of something very traumatic and something very playful at the same time. And so what happened was at the end of the first chapter, I'm 9 years old. It's Christmas Eve. I'm at home with my brother, who's 7 years older. Our parents are at the Saigon Mall, and I'm watching Christmas, probably Scooby-Doo Christmas Eve or something. My brother gets a phone call, and then he puts it down and he says to me, Mom and Dad have been shot in the store. Okay. I'm 9 years old. I have no idea what to do with this information. So I don't do anything. I don't say anything. I'm still watching the cartoons. And my brother says to me, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you crying? And I didn't have an answer for him. In my own mind, for the rest of my life, I thought, I'm just a bad person. My parents just got shot, but I cannot cry. And so that was a very discombobulating moment for me. And at that moment, as I was writing, I thought, I have to write in the second person, because in order for me to get distance from this 9-year-old boy who for the next few decades would control everything about himself emotionally in order to survive this terrain of refugee and emotional displacement, I had to be in complete control of my emotions. And so as a writer, I had to look at myself from the outside. And I think it was because that's the traumatic experience. When you're traumatized, you split in order to cope with whatever's happening to this person that's also yourself as well. And I look back upon the refugee experience. I mean, it took me a very long time to write this memoir because I thought my parents were the ones who lived the traumatic, devastating lives, 40 years of war and refugee displacement and things like this. And I'm like, my life is nothing. Mm-hmm. My life has been very normal. But in fact, my very first memories, when I came to the United States in the refugee camp, in order to leave that camp, you had to have an American sponsor the family. There was nobody willing to sponsor all four of us. So one sponsor took my parents, one sponsor took my 10-year-old brother, one sponsor took 4-year-old me, and my first memories are of being taken away from my parents and howling and screaming because I didn't understand what was happening. And so even from then, from the very first memories, it was splitting, it was displacement, it was trauma.
And with that that use of I and you and that sort of splitting as well, it does also seem to feed into something like a moment ago you used the term the refugee experience. And that's something which we find in the book too, is this sort of, again, to come back to the word I used in the introduction, this tension between this sort of the personal story and, in a sense, a communal story. And there is an idea, I think, associated with having been a refugee or being part of an immigrant, having an immigrant background, that there is almost this pressure to speak for oneself, but also to some way speak for the community or the kind of the general experience that one represents.
I know very well the kind of book that's expected from somebody like me. Mm-hmm. I'm a refugee.
You detail it in points throughout.
In case you want to write your ethnic best-selling memoir, I give you 5 steps in the book to tell you how to do it, okay? And basically, you know, as a refugee in the United States who's often classified as an immigrant, I know exactly how my story will be read. My parents underwent 40 years of traumatic experience. They fled to the United States as refugees. Their 2 sons became extremely successful people. And then they opened this grocery store. They suffered because you can suffer in the United States. In fact, you're expected to acknowledge that you suffer in the United States. But in the end, you achieved the American dream. And if you didn't achieve the American dream, your children achieved the American dream. And look at you. You wrote a book about it. Congratulations. That's how you write the immigrant or refugee best-selling memoir. And I'm just not interested in doing that. And so all those elements are actually in the book, but I want to make sure that the reader is never allowed to interpret my story in that fashion. Because the collective dimension that you're talking about is actually deeply contained. And that the way it's contained is to say, oh, look, Viet wrote the refugee memoir. He is the voice for the voiceless, which I actually have been called. And his story will tell us everything we need to know about the Vietnamese refugee experience. And again, I refuse to let that happen. And so this is a book that is about refugees, but it's not an attempt to say, look, refugees are now a part of the United States. It's awesome. And we should all welcome refugees. Of course we should. But the book is, in the end, an assertion that if we were to actually see the world from refugee perspectives, our world completely unravels. Because our world is premised, for those of us who are citizens or residents, on nation states, our identification with France or the United States or whatever. And the refugee is only allowed in to affirm the nation state. So the refugee is expected, as Dina Nayeri writes about in her book, The Ungrateful Refugee, to always be grateful. And this book refuses gratitude. And this book from the refugee perspective says, if you were actually to look at the world from the refugee point of view, everything is actually destabilized, which is why refugees are so frightening to non-refugees and why we are treated as a crisis instead of a solution to the world's problems.
It's also a sort of, you walk a very, I guess, a very fine line in a sense as well between sort of, in a sense, refusing to write the refugee story, but also recognizing, as you do repeatedly in the book, that there is sort of, particularly in a country, well, I say it's particularly the United States, but maybe in most Western countries, where sort of there are oppressions and injustices which are focused on different groups in a way. So when you write about, for example, the subject of race in the US, there's this kind of this acknowledgement of a sort of collective oppression and collective discrimination. And can you talk a little bit about how one can write about that while also preserving the sort of the individuality of the story and the experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the United States, perhaps here in France as well, I mean, there's an incentive to speak about one's own experience as a part of a community, like in our case, Vietnamese refugees. And so it's a very affirming to say, I'm going to tell the Vietnamese refugee experience and that'll help us become a part of the country and so on. And I'm deeply suspicious of that narrative, because if we look at the history of the United States, the way that immigrants and refugees from non-white countries have become a part of the United States is not simply to say we're Americans or we're Asian Americans or whatever hyphenated Americans. It's also to explicitly or implicitly, usually, say we're also not Black and we're also not Indigenous. So that relational experience of what it means to become an American is always there. And a lot of my fellow Vietnamese refugees and Vietnamese Americans don't acknowledge that experience, which is why during the whole Trump administration period, when there was a whole crisis at the border, et cetera, there was a Vietnamese American gentleman, 80 years old, Steve Nguyen, I remember, Steve Tran, quoted in the LA Times saying, Trump is doing the right thing. He's doing the right thing in not letting in these Muslim and brown refugees, because they're the bad refugees. We are the good refugees. That's the classic American narrative. That's how you become white. That's how you become American. And so this book is also very much about, you know, obviously me, my family, blah, 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 but also taking place against this background of our conditional acceptance into becoming American and my refusal of that, and trying to link the refugee experience to everything else that happens in American history. Because it's totally possible to be a traumatized refugee, to foreground your own victimization for whatever reason, the Vietnam War, French colonization, and so on, and then to come to the United States and to buy property and to participate in the settler colonization of the country. So I'll end with one anecdote, which is that we came and we settled in Fort Indian Town Gap in Pennsylvania. I had no idea why it was called Indian Town Gap. I mean, it never occurred to me for 40 years. Why is this place called Indian Town Gap? Obviously, it was built for the settlers to defend or wage war against indigenous peoples. And then we bought a house, my parents bought a house in Harrisburg. And then a couple of years ago, my brother said, I got the deed to that house. I got the record of the deed. And the deed is in Lower Paxton Township. And the reason why that's important is because in 1700, most of the remaining remnants of the indigenous peoples of that area, the Susquehannock or the Conestoga, were massacred and almost completely wiped out by a vigilante gang called the Paxton Boys, who were never prosecuted for their crimes. So our very act of buying a house, starting the process of the American dream, is taking place literally in the same location that indigenous peoples were massacred. Mm-hmm. And in Vietnam, when American soldiers came, they built their fire bases. They called the area around their fire bases Indian country. So we were the Indians in the American imagination. Then we come to the United States and we are become the citizens, but we're also participating in this ongoing process of the erasure of actual Indians.
Mm-hmm. One of the, I don't know if foil is quite the right word, but when you're dealing with this subject, and particularly with the idea of a certain racial hierarchy in the United States, is a particular Richard Pryor routine, which I was fascinated to find, because I remember I saw this for the first time when I was far too young to see it. And before I had any, I think I was about 12 or 13, and before I had any sense of the racial dynamics in the United States at all. But it's a really fascinating and funny routine where he deals with the way the arrival of Vietnamese refugees will impact upon the lives of Black people. in the United States. Would you just be able to talk a little bit about why you felt not only to sort of, you know, you might be inspired by this your conversation, but you actually needed to include Pryor's voice in your book?
So I have to confess that I'm addicted to Instagram Reels. And I watch Instagram Reels because I like watching stand-up comedians on Instagram Reels. Very, very funny. And I've learned a lot of lessons from them in terms of delivery and so on, because I go on the road and I give a lot of talks and I don't want to bore people. So I have to learn how to give this delivery and tell jokes and everything. And so Pryor was an inspiration as well. Comedians are an inspiration because, you know, the good ones, the ones I like, are funny and scabrous and political all at the same time, and they don't explain the joke. Mm-hmm. You know, if you explain the joke, you sort of kill it. If you explain the story, you kill it. Pryor, and I can only paraphrase, I cannot actually say what Pryor says, but the entire transcript of his routine is in the book. And I knew it was disturbing because I asked my undergraduate research assistant to transcribe it for me, and she refused. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was like, I cannot actually write these words. She's Vietnamese. Yeah. And she's like, I cannot actually write these words down for you because they're so offensive, even though Richard Pryor himself said them. So the routine, you can find it on YouTube. You can find it on CD, whatever. It's called New Black People, although obviously he doesn't say Black People. And it's 1975, and he's talking about the arrival of Vietnamese refugees in the United States. And he's actually being quite sympathetic that, you know, these Vietnamese who are the new Black people will take our place, and they will absorb all the racism that we've encountered. And he's, you know, pointing to the fact that this is how the immigration process works in the United States. You come in, you're the new other, you get the racist treatment that's been reserved for everybody else. But then he connects it to the fact that, of course, what's going to happen, he gives this example, like they're adopting these Vietnamese orphans. They're so cute, these Vietnamese orphans. But what about all of the Black orphans that are already in the country and so on? And it's so painful, the routine. It's very funny, but it's also so painful because he's putting his finger directly in his very succinct way, 3-minute skit on how the treatment of African-Americans is actually completely related to America's warfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it quite sort of, I can remember like when I'm not sure I've seen it in that time since I saw it maybe what, like 30 years ago now, but the sort of the, as you talk about like the rhythm of the delivery and something, there's something incredibly, both oddly powerful, but also hilarious about it. It's sort of, yeah, really sort of, it shows the kind of the impact that comedy sort of, those kind of lines well delivered can have. Let's talk a little bit about your family, because, I mean, it is a memoir, it is a very personal thing, but it's, particularly the figures of your parents feature so prominently in the book for obvious reasons. But perhaps we can begin with a short extract that you were going to read and then pick it up from there.
So this is passage near the end of the book. It's about my mother, and so you'll learn all about her. And then we'll talk about it. Ma was born in 1937 as Nguyen Thi Bai, a poor girl in a poor northern Vietnamese village. She dies in 2018 as Linda Kim Nguyen, American citizen, traveler of a life both ordinary and epic. At 17, she married and became a refugee for the first time. At 17, I almost did not graduate from high school because I nearly failed pre-calculus. At 38, a mother of two biological sons and one adopted daughter, Ma became a refugee for the second time, her sequel starting in an alien country. At 38, I, with no children, struggled with writing a short story about Ma. Ma's first name is Bai. Giving children numbers as names was common in rural Vietnam. Families often had so many children, some wouldn't survive. Why give a girl a real name? As a girl, the seventh child, she deserved no more. Ma hated this birth name. In her last decades, she wanted to be called by her American name, Linda. But both her names feel alien on my tongue. I never called her by her name, only Ma as a child, Ma as an adult. Her refugee path shaped even what I called her. Northerners say Ma, Southerners say Ma, and I, as always, am somewhere in between. Most Americans who met Ma probably only saw her mortal, unextraordinary coil. If they knew anything about her, they might know she'd been a shopkeeper, businesswoman, refugee. If they knew nothing about her, she was another Asian woman who didn't speak good English. Ma, or Ma, never wanted to mention how she received only a grade school education. I'm telling on her, and yet she should be told on, even if it is not my secret to tell. Look at what Ma accomplished with just a grade school education, overcoming everything, almost everything, except her mind. Defeated, like so many heroes, not by others, but by herself. A hero, but not a soldier. People like Ma, who will not be remembered by history, are also a part of history, drafted as reluctant players in horrific wars. Unlike soldiers, these civilians, many of them women and children, never get the recognition they deserve. Some endure more terror, see more horror than some soldiers. And the wars of the 20th century, including the ones in Vietnam, killed far more civilians than soldiers. Civilian stories can be war stories too. Perhaps what happened to my mother was simply her body and mind's fate. But history and war took their turns hammering Ma, unnerving her, breaking her. My mother, child of colonization and war. Me, grandchild of colonization and war. Also the child of Ba Ma, who chose each other. For all that Ma was lost to us for so many years, my father's love was not lost to her. She saw this reality from the orbit of her sur-reality. I know, because the last words Ma says on her hospital bed in the family room, before she says the Lord's Prayer with my father, are for my father, to my father. Am Yo An. This I will translate, even if the translation is not enough. I love you. After the Lord's Prayer, silence. My brother, the doctor, gives Ma morphine, while my sister-in-law, the doctor, watches. Ma's breathing slows. I lean close to tell Ma in Vietnamese that I love her. She lived a good life, a life of hard work and sacrifice, a heroic life, a life that demanded so much strength, devotion, and love. I don't know where Ma found those qualities, but I am the beneficiary. These words, this faith in her, this betrayal of her, are the outcome. Ma's eyes do not open. She gives no sign of hearing. Her breathing finally stops. It is midnight. Her journey on this earth, complete. My mother is mine, and my mother is also other to me. My brother makes a phone call. In an hour, a courteous stranger who might be Filipino arrives with a gurney, fills out a form, takes away my mother, leaves the empty hospital bed in the family room, and drives my mother into the night. I remember Ma loved me. Everything else, I can forget.
Thank you so much. We heard during that extract, so obviously that particular extract focused on your mother, but at one moment when talking about your father, you used the term Bama, which we find in the book. And we've talked a lot about the sort of the division of the self so far. But one thing that's also crucial, particularly when talking about the relationship to your parents, is this kind of fusion of two selves, which, of course, at that moment that you read us, they then divide again. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about that concept of Ba Ma. Was that something that existed in your family as a sort of a way to talk about parents, or was it something more that needed to be created to talk about their specific fusion in a way?
Yeah, and you know, I obviously would call my father Ba, my mother Ma, but together they would be Ba Ma. We don't say parents, we just say Ba Ma. Mm-hmm. And these words are very powerful to me. Like, you know, the Vietnamese language is very powerful to me because I came at the age of 4 and I was fluent in Vietnamese at the age of 4. And 40 plus years later, I'm still fluent in Vietnamese at the age of 4. I'm so good in Vietnamese. Okay, I'm so good in Vietnamese that when I went to Vietnam and I was speaking Vietnamese, people were like, oh my God, your Vietnamese is so good for a Korean. But then, you know, the thing about this language is that I associate it completely with my childhood, my upbringing, the fact that I lived in a household where we only spoke Vietnamese at home. And so the very sound of the language is actually very emotional for me. I remember I was in a drugstore in Los Angeles randomly, and this guy walked up to me. He's an older man, 40-something, 50-something years old, Asian, he's on his cell phone, and he's talking to somebody, and he says, Con ơi, bà ơi, con ăn cơm chưa? I started to cry. What it means is, child or son, perhaps, it's dad. Have you eaten yet? Which is what my parents would always say every day when they would see me at night. And it's what you say to your friends and your loved ones and so on. So the stereotype is Vietnamese people don't say, I love you. Instead, they say, Ăn cơm chưa? Have you eaten yet? Is there a way of demonstrating care and concern to make sure you're full? So just hearing that man's voice saying this, and you know, it just reawakened all of these emotions in me. And that's how I knew I was Vietnamese. That's how I know I'm Vietnamese. One of the ways I know. Because as inefficient or incapable as I am in Vietnamese, the language is, it's resonant within me because it carries all of our history as a family and our refugee experience in these intonations and these very specific words. And so I can't help but feel, you know, this feeling when I say ba má, which is why I try to resist everywhere I can to say parents or father or mother, but instead to use these words very specifically in the book.
It does, I think, as a reader, it has that sort of, the experience, it sort of, it grows on you, the sort of, as you go through the book and you have this sense of this unit. So when, you know, when we get to that moment where that unit sunders, it's, I mean, we obviously don't feel what your father feels, but we feel the sort of the profundity of that separation. At a moment you write that Ba is the family documentarian. And that sort of immediately set my sort of senses kind of tingling. It's kind of like, okay, somebody who's writing a memoir referring to sort of his father as the documentarian. And I'd be interested to hear a little bit your reflection on that. Like, is this something that you feel perhaps you've inherited from your father, this kind of this taste for collecting information, for telling a story, for kind of constructing a family history?
Yeah, looking back on my past, I realized that my father was really cutting edge in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. Like the few photographs that we have from Vietnam are probably taken by my father. The ones when we came to Pennsylvania are taken by my father. He was an early adopter of the VCR. That's how I was traumatized at home because I would watch these movies I wasn't supposed to watch because, you know, we didn't have Blockbuster back in the day. So he bought the VCR, and then where we would go to rent video cassettes would be at the Vietnamese mm-hmm. video store. And so my dad has no idea what's in the collection. I mean, there's like pornography, I know. And there was Apocalypse Now and all this kind of stuff. So I was watching that. And he had a video camera like it was this big, but he was the documentarian. And then I didn't have very many photos of my childhood. I think I only had one because that's when we fled from Vietnam, my father only had one photograph of his sons. And that's all I had when we were little boys. But then we left behind my adopted sister. And then many years later, she sent us photographs. And this was the first time, this is only a few years ago, that I would see these photographs that my father took. And I wanted to include them in the book because I found them so moving. You know, my father took this photograph of my mother and me when I was about probably 3 years old. And I had never seen these photos. Obviously, I was there. I have no memories of it. And there's the photograph in the back is us walking away from the camera. So those are my father's photographs. And looking at that photograph in particular, I thought, wow, this is a pre-lapsarian moment. This is the moment before the fall of Saigon, when my parents thought obviously things would keep on going the way they were. This was a moment of wondrous love mm-hmm. for the family. And then everything was going to be ruptured within a few months or a year. And so yeah, he's left us documents, and the cover of the American edition, which is not the same as the UK edition, this is my father's face. This is my father There's a black and white photograph. Anybody who's Vietnamese has a photograph like this of their parents. Our parents, when they were young, were awesome. They were beautiful. And so the original black and white photograph, my father looks like a movie star. His hair is all slicked back. It's very, you know, romantic, black and white, soft focus lighting and everything. And then instead of just reproducing it, the designer, you know, did this with this the portrait of my father. And I guess maybe sometimes people think it's me, but it's actually my father. So yeah, I mean, all that, my father is being the documentarian, and then me thinking about my parents' lives before I was born, and this whole sense that for their generation, they lived through all this trauma. But if you look at the photographic evidence, it's actually all beautiful and all glamorous, because this was before iPhones. You only took photographs for the very special occasions. You wanted to make sure you looked good. So those were the documents that were left behind for me.
There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I suspect there will be questions from the audience. So I don't want to hog too much more of your time, but I do want to finish on the subject of you as the writer, because this is something which you come back to about the sort of how the desire to write drove you, and how the experience of writing has, in certain ways, helped you and shaped you. So there's one moment where you say, you refer to your writing as your real home, which I found very telling. And another moment, which makes me think of something you said just towards the beginning of this conversation, you write, and this is you, but addressing yourself here, you write, you do not deal well with emotional difficulty except in your writing. So to finish our part of the conversation, would you be able to talk a little bit about the experience of that sort of the writing space for you and the importance that played in the sort of the wider tale you're telling in A Man of Two Faces?
I don't think you mentioned in your introduction that one of the other tensions that I have is between the emotions that drive me as a writer. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, a belief in beauty and art on one extreme. And on the other hand, on the other extreme, anger and rage, which drive me as well. And everything else in between. But, you know, when I was growing up, we had no books in our household, which was really weird because we didn't even have a Bible. My parents were devout Catholics and we didn't have a Bible. I don't know why. And so my way of coping with my parents' really difficult life, you know, running the Saigon Malaya, I hardly ever saw them, was just to go to the library and borrow books and read and just escape the refugee world through these stories. And the stories had nothing to do with me. The stories were like, you know, Charles Dickens and Tom Brown's School Days and things like that. Nevertheless, I, as a young Vietnamese refugee boy, totally responded to this literature. And it taught me an early lesson, which is that Dickens or whoever, Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, Jane Austen, when they were writing their books, they weren't thinking they were writing to a Vietnamese refugee boy. And yet the stories and the poetry still connected. The lesson from that is that I, as a writer, do not have to worry about whether any of you are going to read my books. That's not my obligation. It wasn't Jane Austen's obligation to care about Vietnamese refugees. So why should it be my obligation to care about, you know, Englishmen? Let's use an example. But that's freeing, because in fact, if we write just with the beauty and the art and the yearning for storytelling and the desire to reach some kind of a truth, we will connect with everybody, all, and, you know, beyond our lifetimes. So that's a real powerful impulse for me to and, you know, shared by all writers, I'm sure, the beauty and the art. But then at a certain age, I realized that much of what was so persuasive and powerful for me was either explicitly built upon the demonization of people like me, the enduring racism of the Western canon, or the implicit erasure of people like me. So if you go to the example of English literature, for example, Edward Said says, you know, in Culture and Imperialism, you read all these books, they may not have any brown people in them, but there's brown people being murdered somewhere in order to make these lives possible for these people in Victorian England. That was a realization I came to in college, and that's when the rage and the anger kicked in. The realization that, in fact, this canon that I love so much and still do is also premised upon the erasure, the exploitation, the genocide of not Asians, Africans, Latin Americans, and indigenous peoples, and so on. So that spectrum of emotions is what drove me to become a writer. But maybe I'll just end with the very first book I ever wrote, which was when I was in the third grade, eight or nine years old. And, you know, we had to write and draw a book. And so my book was Lester the Cat. Lester was an urban cat, stricken with ennui. Bored with city life, he fled to the countryside. There, he found love with a country cat. That was my first book. I wrote and drew it, and then the San Jose Public Library gave me a book award, my first taste of literary fame, and set me on the path to more than 30 years of misery in trying to become a writer. That's the origin story.
Well, on those 30 years of misery, I guess it's a perfect place to hand over to you. If you do have a question for Viet, raise your hand. We'll get the microphone to you because there's people all over the shop listening, so we need to be able to hear your question. Lady over there, microphone's just coming around behind you.
Hi, thanks so much for your time in coming here to Paris. Really glad to see you here. So my questions would be about more about the construction of the identity of you as a writer, as a human being, as a refugee coming to realize that your identity of living in America as an American citizen, and then also your identity as a Vietnamese and how you connect with the country as it is now, because it has changed so much. To give a background, I'm also Vietnamese, but I was born and raised in Vietnam, in the northern of Vietnam, and I had lived with the history of the war told in the northern perspective. So in a sense, when I left the country to study abroad, I started to realize more images of the country compared to what I have learned at home. So in this sense, I also think that you might have a lot of things to share in your journey of discovering the country again and your identity. So yeah, thanks.
Thank you for the question. And I think I have a parallel life because I was raised in a Vietnamese refugee community in California from 1975 onwards. And, you know, basically what happened is because of the war and this vast diaspora was created, growing up in the Vietnamese refugee community through the 70s, 80s, 90s, up until the present, it was like living in a nostalgic recreation of Vietnam. Everything froze in 1975. The language froze in 1975 in a very particular kind of southern Vietnamese language. We used the same flags, sang the same patriotic songs. There was a portion, a very vocal portion of the community that believed we would take the country back. And so the entire Vietnamese American community was dominated by this whole nostalgic desire to recreate, perpetuate, take back the past. I was growing up, however, and I was growing up and my parents were telling me, you are 100% Vietnamese. So that was being reinforced to me too. It was very weird because when my parents became American citizens, they changed their names to Joseph and Linda. I was like, what's happening here? I thought we were 100% Vietnamese. And then they said, don't you want to change your name? I was like, what? So I tried on different names. Troy, that was at the top of the list. So you laugh, it doesn't work. And I think because my parents knew they were 100% Vietnamese, changing their names was not a problem because they knew who they were. But I didn't know who I was. So for me, hanging on to my name in its Americanized version, Viet Thanh Nguyen, that was my way of still retaining some kind of connection to Vietnam. And that was kind of important because I when I was growing up, other Vietnamese refugees saw me as a banana, a whitewash, you know, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. And because I didn't speak very good Vietnamese, and they all did. Now, the current generation of young Vietnamese Americans, my own students, for example, they don't speak Vietnamese either. So I was 30 years ahead of my time in being whitewashed. But what that taught me, because I did not appreciate being seen by my fellow Vietnamese refugees in this way, what that taught me was an inherent skepticism towards the idea of authenticity. Even from a very young age, I was not convinced in this idea that there was some kind of authentic Vietnamese thing that we were all supposed to gravitate around. And so when I went back to Vietnam for the first time in 2002, I went back with the explicit intent, understanding that I would not become Vietnamese. Not because I didn't want to. I just didn't believe that after 20 plus years, returning to the country would somehow turn me instantly into authentically Vietnamese or instill in me that desire. And in fact, when I got back there and after many trips, I went from 2002 to 2014 many times. You know, one of the things that I was convinced of was that the Vietnamese themselves have a very complicated relationship to authenticity because they do want to say we're authentically Vietnamese, you're Vietnamese, welcome home, blah, blah, blah. And is it authentic Vietnamese culture to try to drive a Lamborghini on a potholed street in the cities? I mean, I saw that. Is that authentically Vietnamese? It is. Whatever Vietnamese people do is authentically Vietnamese, which means that it's not authentically Vietnamese. And the Vietnamese refugee diaspora, I think, hangs on to this notion that we have to freeze Vietnamese culture in a certain way. But I'm just completely disabused of that notion. And then going back to Vietnam, I had to struggle with, of course, how the Vietnamese refugees hate Vietnamese communism and how Vietnamese communists hate the Vietnamese refugees officially. And then come to the realization that I needed to take a position outside of that binary, because it was a lose-lose proposition. And so eventually I would write a book called Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, where it was very important for me to go back and talk about the memory of the war, but not just between Americans and Vietnamese, not just between the North and the South, not just between anti-communists and communists, but to say, in fact, the Vietnam War was also fought in Cambodia and Laos, and Korean soldiers were there. And if we think about the war in that fashion, all these binaries collapse, because the binaries actually serve both the Americans and the Vietnamese, because the Vietnamese get to deny that the war was fought in Cambodia and Laos. So like, well, the Americans were the enemies, the French were the enemies, we're the good guys. And then all of this horrible stuff that happened in Cambodia and Laos, where millions of people were killed, is just sort of not discussed. And then eventually in this book, I went another step, which is that I had to confront my own family's history. If you go to Vietnam, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but as tourists in Vietnam, I think tourists in Vietnam are often, if they encounter Vietnamese history at all, it's like the war history that you find in the historical museums. But it's also this idea that the Chinese have colonized Vietnam for 1,000 years. And this makes us Vietnamese. We will never forget this. We will always fight. We will all be opposed to the outsiders and so on. Well, when my family and parents were born in North Vietnam and then grew up there. And then in 1954, the country was divided. And 800,000 Vietnamese Catholics moved south, aided by the CIA and the French Navy, and they formed the base of the Southern Catholic government, anti-communist government. And from my understanding, many of us Vietnamese Catholics were resettled with the aid of U.S. money and the South Vietnamese government on indigenous land, of the land of ethnic minorities. We were settled in Ban Ma Thuot in the Central Highlands. Back then, it was mostly so-called ethnic minorities. And my father told me, yeah, we got a grant, we bought some land, we sold it, then we bought some more land in Ban Ma Thuot. And that's when their Vietnamese dream started. To me, this sounds like settler colonization. But the majority of Vietnamese people, of whom I'm a part and maybe you're a part, we don't talk about that. Just as Americans don't want to talk about genocide and settler colonization. So my skepticism of the homeland, of authenticity, of origins, makes me very suspicious of these narratives of return, these narratives of restoration, this idea that we're all Vietnamese and that's a good thing. It is a good thing. But our privileges as Vietnamese people, from my perspective, are also completely wrapped up with the fact that Vietnamese people are also imperialists and colonizers in our own right. Like, modern Vietnam would not exist without the fact that we conquered a whole bunch of people, and Southern Vietnam is like formerly the Kingdom of the Chams and like half of Cambodia, just like the United States is like half of Mexico. So all of that is wrapped up, and probably another reason why the Vietnamese government doesn't like me when I say things like that.
Do we have
If anybody down there, I can see you. Yeah. So if you want to wave your hand, I can also see you from down there as well.
Don't be shy.
There's a question.
We got a question
yeah.
right down the front here. Yeah.
But raise your hand if you want. I can see you.
There we go.
Hi, thank you again for taking time to come and speak with us this evening. It's an honor. I did have a little bit of a question about your experience with assimilation versus integration. So a little bit of context is that I'm also Vietnamese American, and I'm the first in my family to graduate high school, let alone make it through to a master's degree. I'm on my way to a doctorate's degree right now.
So, congratulations.
Thank you.
She flipped her hair in case you didn't see it. It was awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. We should be proud of ourselves. Yeah. We worked very hard to get here. But something that I find that is perhaps not as talked about, but maybe it could be the subject of the next couple of novels in the new wave of Vietnamese American writing, it's that our growing up with like Betty by Night and watching clips like that, but then also being encouraged to do whatever the white kids are doing to fit in. I find that there's like this interesting line that's being towed between trying to fit in, but also being 100% Vietnamese at home. And you as an educator, parent, and someone who's lived out this experience, I'm curious to see what your major observations have been about this line between assimilation and integration.
You know, I dealt with those questions when I was in high school and college and so on. And then I went on the lecture circuit as a full-grown adult over the last 10 years and talked to a lot of people, students and younger folks like yourself. And you know what? Nothing much has changed. So even today's generation of people of Asian descent here or in the United States and so on, you have certain advantages. Like you have BTS, you have Boba. You have all these, you have K-pop. The whole global cultural landscape has changed so that it's not like the way it was when I was young. The way it was when I was young, you know, in high school, we Asians called ourselves the Asian invasion. Okay? That was a racist language. That's all we had for ourselves. The cultural conflict was already built in. So you would imagine that today with all of these pop cultural things that are really popular from Asia, that it would all be resolved. But it hasn't been because people are still asking the same kinds of questions. How do we fit in, et cetera, et cetera. So my resolution, my answer to that is that historically that has been treated as a culture crisis. East versus West, never the twain shall meet. And yes, it is a culture crisis, but in reality, the culture crisis, the East-West split, the identity conflict, these are all simply ramifications or consequences of a political conflict, colonization, genocide, these kinds of things. This is what produces East-West conflict, right? It's not the reverse. And so insofar as we continue to treat these issues as cultural problems, you will never resolve them because you blame yourself. You're like, well, my parents are screwing me up. Or it becomes an internal issue. Like, how do I solve my internal problem? It's not your internal problem. It's a historical problem. And I try to lay this out in the book, what I think this narrative is. But, you know, for me, it was really crucial to move from the identity problem when I was 19, saying, oh my God, I'm actually an Asian American, I'm radicalized. And to realize that there's a hard limit to that radicalization. If you stop at the level of identity and culture and assimilation and integration, in fact, it's not radical. That is a process of assimilation because the United States is perfectly capable of absorbing you as an Asian American. In fact, we've reached a moment where being Asian American is not oppositional anymore. Being Asian American is actually quite the pathway towards assimilation. You're expected to talk about your identity crisis and turn it into a story, and representation matters. So in the book, I talk about how it's very important to move from these slogans of that foreground representation to thinking about decolonization and thinking about this larger history instead.
I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Is there anybody in the back line? Oh, there's one on the balcony here.
Sorry, my hand went up before I really came up with a good question. But what was interesting to me reading, same as everybody else, Vietnamese American, and I wanted to tell you something that my dad said after he read The Sympathizer. He read, I could do better than that. And so I said, go for it, write your book. And he didn't read your five-step process, your recipe, but he did follow it. And so he wrote a book that's called Cost to Freedom, and it's in his own English, which I find very interesting. It's a bit like Saigon Moy is never translated, right? We're expected to understand what it is. And so he has this book. And what I think was interesting about that is the reaction that he had to your work. And he's like a lot of other people of that generation, San Jose and whatnot. And I was wondering what it was like for you going back home to California and being with the Vietnamese people of that generation and how you're received and how your work is received.
I think I already know your dad. I remember I did this event in San Jose at one of the community colleges, mostly to a younger, you know, student audience, but there was an older gentleman, probably your dad's age, Vietnamese gentleman, and he came up to the line. He didn't have a book or anything to talk to me, and he just looked at me and sneered and said, what do you know about Vietnam? What do you know about this history? And I think we've all experienced that, those of us from the younger generation. And I get it. I mean, they lived this history. So who is this young person I'm old to some of you, but I'm young to them. Who is this young person to tell us about what we experienced? We know the communists. You don't. How dare you tell this history? And I think I understand the frustration because, of course, Vietnamese culture is very hierarchical. The older people are supposed to speak. And it's inflected even more in the refugee community or diaspora because your father's generation, my father's generation, they have so many stories to tell. But they realize or they feel that their own children won't listen to them. And they also know that the Americans won't listen to them, or maybe the French won't listen to them because they write in English. I mean, they write in Vietnamese and they speak in Vietnamese. And that's not what's going to be heard. So who gets heard? People like me, who write their books and publish in English. So that's why I wanted to bring up in the excerpt that I read, the sense of telling on secrets, betraying secrets. I think it's important to tell these stories, but I also recognize that people like my mother, like your father, probably don't want their stories told by me, right? Because what do I know? So there's a tension there between the older generation and the younger generation that I don't think is unique to Vietnamese refugees. And I know I'm hated. I know I'm hated. You know how I know I'm hated? Because at one of my more recent events, this young Vietnamese American woman comes up to me, a little bit younger than you, and she says, "You are the second most hated person in my parents' household." The most hated person? Joe Biden. My own students come up to me, Vietnamese students, and said, "Yeah, my parents say you're a communist," you know, which would, you know, surprise the Communist Party in Vietnam, who think I'm an anti-communist. So I don't know where I'm going with this, except simply to say that I feel all of these contradictions, all these tensions. It's not resolvable, you know. It is a part and parcel of the generational experience, of the experience of displacement, of the fact that our parents and grandparents went through, again, these horrific experiences, and they're never heard. And I empathize with that. And they have to watch your generation, my generation, tell the stories and get the attention and become treated as the voices for the voiceless. They're the voiceless, but they're not voiceless. And as I say in the book, I quote Arundhati Roy, there's no such thing as the voiceless. There's only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard. And that is actually what defines the first generation refugee experience.
I think that's a perfect place on which to leave it. A Man of Two Faces, we have plenty of copies available of this extraordinary book in both the American and the British edition, so choose your favorite cover. We also have copies of The Refugees, of course, The Sympathizer and The Committed. For that, I can't recommend this book highly enough. It's fascinating, it's compelling, it's also a deeply emotional read, and I'm so happy that Viet was here to talk with us about it tonight. Please join me in saying thank you to him.
Thank you so much, Adam. It was wonderful. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Freiman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.